Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. At hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Support for this podcast comes from U.S. Bank. When it's time for a new credit card, the best ones do way more than just buy stuff. And that's why U.S. Bank offers credit cards that make every day more rewarding. Earn cash back, score points when you shop, dine out, travel, or binge watch, or get a low intro APR. U.S. Bank credit cards were designed to fit your lifestyle. So make every day more rewarding and check out usbank.com/creditcard. U.S. Bank credit cards are issued by U.S. Bank National Association N.D. Some restrictions may apply. Member FDIC.
Welcome to the RotoWire Mixed Martial Arts Podcast, brought to you by ESPN Plus, the home of UFC 250. I'm Jake Litarski, joined today by John Littering. If you're on Twitter, give John a follow at JonLitterine. You can follow me at RotoJake. Today is basically a historic day in the history of DraftKings MMA. Not today, but Saturday will be, because we've got $1 million on the line. UFC 250, Amanda Nunes versus Felicia Spencer. First ever millionaire maker on DraftKings for MMA. This is a big big deal for us MMA fans, us MMA content providers here. There's million makers in golf and MMA coming up. So definitely as sports start to come back a little bit, we're getting a bigger taste of the action here. So very excited to bring some content, break down this card with John here. And I guess just to get started, John, man, how have you been since the last fight? Are you impressed with Gilbert Burns? Any other current events worth noting here?
Yeah, I mean, I think you'd have to be impressed with Gilbert Burns. What he did to Tyron Woodley last weekend was extremely impressive. And I think it's – I really think Burns is legitimately terrific, but I'm really worried about Woodley. 38 years old and – back-to-back losses to Burns and Kamaru Usman, and not just losses, just dominated in both fights, not the least bit competitive, and that's really concerning.
We haven't touched much on how Justin Gaethje looked, because that was the last card that we got together to break down here. I mean, that's been phenomenal. I cannot wait for him to get a crack at Khabib and see what happens. And then the other thing, in the most recent, I guess, pay-per-view card, the abrupt retirement of Henry Cejudo. I mean, that changes the whole landscape of the bantamweight division. I mean, do you think this is permanent, or how long do you think this is going to last?
It's hard to say. I mean, I would certainly think it's going to last for a little while, if for no other reason than you have a couple big bantamweight fights on this card, and then you have – sounds like the UFC is looking to do Piotr Jan and Jose Aldo for the title that's now vacant. So if, you add all that together, you're looking at – the division being, you know, fairly tied up for at least the next little while. Mm-hmm. So
well, you got Marlon Moraes out there calling out Dominic Cruz today here. So there's a lot of exciting fights in this division, and it definitely gets started on Saturday night. So that's a good kind of segue into what we want to discuss today. But before we jump in, I wanted to mention an awesome promo we're running with our friends over at ESPN Plus. If you sign up through the links on our site, you get a free month of RotoWire. That's full service, all sports, plus DFS, betting tools, what have you. Just go to rotowire.com/subscribe and locate the ESPN Plus promo on the bottom. Or if you already have a RotoWire account, haven't subscribed yet, just click on subscribe now in the top right to begin. I'll put the another direct link in the podcast description, but if you're getting the pay-per-view, you're going to need to have ESPN Plus anyway. Might as well get some free RotoWire content on that. And obviously we were talking about this beforehand, we're running content for all sports that are out there, KBO and Bundesliga, all that stuff is hot, and we're getting going. Basically anything that you could want content for, you can find it here on RotoWire. But John, let's get started here. We've got a main event, a featherweight championship on the line. The greatest female fighter of all time, Amanda Nunes, comes in as a massive, massive betting favorite against Felicia Spencer. I mean, the money line on that is Nunes -630. The comeback is Spencer +465. The DraftKings salaries, you know, this is about as high as it gets. I mean, you see some crazier favorites, maybe a little higher, but Nunes is 9,400. Spencer is 6,800. And the thing about this is you don't necessarily see odds to finish like this in women's fights all the time, but -335, Vegas thinks someone's getting stopped in this one. John, we don't have to go too far into this technical breakdown, but I guess I'm looking to see, you know, can Amanda Nunes get the finish that we need to hit that value in DraftKings? And I guess what's your general take on this fight in this matchup?
I think she can. If you look at Felicia Spencer, who fought Chris Cyborg just about a year ago, Spencer lasted until the end of the third round in that fight, but she took a ton of punishment. Mm-hmm. It could have been earlier than that, and she managed to survive. And then, so if you want to go by that, look at what Nunes did to Cyborg. So mm-hmm. I definitely think there's a scenario in which Nunes can pay off despite her high salary. It's the same case this division's been in for a long, long time. They essentially created the whole thing in the first place for Cyborg. And it's pretty much left the division without any legitimate contenders. Even Nunes, yes, she beat Cyborg, but she's a natural bantamweight. So even their champions essentially fighting up a division. It's a really, really difficult situation for the company.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the tough thing is if she gets back by Spencer, like a lot of people expect her to, I mean, what's next out there? You know, is she going to fight Megan Anderson, who got beat by Spencer? Maybe. Otherwise, you're basically fighting bantamweights that are moving up, so you might as well go back and defend bantamweight next. And
It's hard. I mean, Spencer's only lost one fight in her career. She's 8-1, but that was the Cyborg fight. But she's won exactly one fight in a row. You know, so it's not like she's run off some long winning streak and she's deserving of a title shot. This is a fight that's essentially necessitated by the circumstances. And who knows? We don't know what's going on behind the scenes. With the whole pandemic and everything, perhaps the UFC was trying to book a bigger fight for the main event here or something, and they couldn't get it done for whatever reason. So, you know, we don't know what's going on, but it's tough. This is a hard fight to really break down because it's essentially really straightforward. Like, I'd love to give you some sort of analysis that's different from what everybody's saying, but it's just not there.
I mean, every aspect of the game, I think Nunes is superior.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The one thing if you want to say anything about Nunes, maybe you could say she definitely got hit more in her last fight against Jermaine Durandamy than she did in recent memory. Mm-hmm. She absorbed more punishment on the feet, but that's not Spencer's game. Spencer mm-hmm. is essentially just a straight up ground specialist. She's won eight. She was won eight fight wins in her career. Half of them have come via submission. So she's essentially a ground specialist. And I will say, I do think she probably is more deserving of title fight at this time than Megan Anderson would be. But you know, the bar there is kind of low. Mm-hmm. There's not a whole host the other options. So look, it is what it is. And you're right. If Nunes wins this fight going away like we expect her to, the division's going to be in even worse shape than it is now, because that's going to leave them with one less quote unquote contender. Mm-hmm. And they're going to have to come up with something creative, whether mm-hmm.
maybe the season of the Ultimate Fighter.
I don't know.
Something like that. I mean, they're going to have to do something.
yeah, whether it's, I don't know, sign somebody who they're not talking about who might be a legitimate threat, get somebody to move up, and you know, whatever it is, they're going to have to do something creative, because as it is right now, at least for going by who's currently on the roster, these are the types of fights you're going to continue to see in this division.
Exactly. So I want to bring this talk back to DFS just a little bit here. You know, at 9,400, she is the highest priced fighter on the slate. People are wondering, you know, is that price tag too high maybe? I'm not one of them. The only downside in Nunes, I think, is you're going to see very, very high ownership. And the reason for that is because it should be. I mean, her last four fights, she scored 125, 109, 117, 123 DraftKings points. Had she been 9,400, and she hasn't been necessarily, for all those fights, that's 13.3x value, 11.6, 12.4, 13.1. Speaking very generally in DFS terms, I mean, you're looking at about 10x to cash in a tournament. If you want to have a shot at taking down one, you probably need 12x or greater, and that's pretty much where she's been at in those last four fights. I mean, she hasn't had under 104 DraftKings points since the Shevchenko fights that went to a decision. This is a five-round main event, and it's the only five-round fight on the entire card, so there's more room to score that way. I don't know. If I made, you know, 10 lineups, I got to think at least 8 or 9 of them are having Nunes in there, because I'm confident in her to win. I'm pretty confident in her to get a stoppage, especially, I mean, despite how tough we saw Spencer fight against Cyborg, well, not fight, but take punches. Again, in the later rounds, we'll see if Nunes can have this. And, you know, maybe Spencer does get a takedown, but, you know, Nunes, we haven't seen it in a while, but her jiu-jitsu game is more than respectable. So I don't see a way that Nunes loses. I think she can score, tally up a lot of strikes. She'll have a speed advantage and just a general stand-up advantage. So I think this is, as close to, I don't want to call it a free square necessarily, because you're going to have to zig and zag and do some weird things in large field GPPs, and you definitely don't want 100% exposure to anybody, but the exposure here has got to be pretty high. I have no problem paying up 9,400 for her.
No, I think she's definitely worth it. It's just, as you mentioned, it's always a risk, because it's just such a large portion of your salary cap dedicated to one fighter. And if, God forbid, something goes wrong, it's almost impossible to cash. Mm-hmm. But that being said, she's probably, if not one of the biggest locks on the card. Mm-hmm. So you definitely want to try and get her in somewhere.
Yeah. And last thing, I don't really see enough scoring from Spencer, even in a 5-round fight, to consider stacking this. Sometimes, you know, we always kind of have this conversation with the 5-round fights, but maybe in a cash game, if you want to be able to put like O'Malley and Menefield and some other giant favorites in your lineup here, but there's not much benefit to that either.
No, there's not. Spencer is not a great stand-up fighter, and on top of that, she's giving up a ton of strength to Nunes in addition to the power. So you would seem to think her biggest and only chance of winning would be on the mat, and that doesn't lend itself to stack potential, because she just wouldn't rack up the necessary points.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's not like she's going to take Nunes down 8 times and get 10 reversals. That's just, I don't see it. So, yeah, so I'm pretty much out on Spencer. You know, I usually will make 10, 20 lineups for a contest or something along those lines. I don't think I'm going to have little or any Spencer exposure in this one necessarily. But like I said, I'm up on Nunes. I think she's a pretty safe play. You almost have to lock her in cash games. And I think there's a fairly good chance she's in the millionaire winner. I mean, that's pretty much how we're going to end each of these fight breakdowns. Like, which one of these fighters has a better chance to be in a millionaire winner? Because, heck, I want one of you guys to win $1 million. So we'll leave it at that with Nunes Spencer. Want to move on to the co-main in the bantamweight division. One of three bantamweight fights we're going to talk about on this card. I watched a little tape here. These fights are very challenging to break down here. But let's see where things stand here. We'll start with Rafael Asunciao against Cody Garbrandt. Asunciao 7,600. Garbrandt 8,600. That matches up with the betting odds here. Garbrandt -155. Comeback on Asunciao +135. The odds to finish here, surprising, -155 here. I don't know, John, what do you think about this one?
This is one I went back and forth on a little bit. It's an interesting fight because both guys have some red flags. They've combined to lose 5 fights in a row, which is really hard to believe when you think about the quality names of both these guys. Both these guys who are, you know, legitimate top contenders. In Garbrandt's case, a former UFC bantamweight champion. I ended up picking Sun Tzu for two main reasons. I was leaning towards him anyway, and then I saw the what I think is a fairly substantial gap in salary between the two. I don't think there's $1,000 worth of salary difference between these two guys. Garbrandt's $8,600, Sun Tzu's $7,600. So that kind of just reinforced the way I was leaning to begin with. My main issue with Garbrandt is, and this is going to sound eerily similar to what I said about Justin Gaethje before his fight against Tony Ferguson, is he's a stubborn brawler with terrible fight IQ. He's emotional. He goes in and tries to knock his opponent's heads off, and you can't win every single fight that way. It's not possible. Now, Gaethje deserves a ton of credit in the Ferguson fight because I didn't think he could, and he changed the way he fought. He was still aggressive, and he still displayed power, but he was much more smarter about picking his spots. So full credit to him there. Now I have to see Garbrandt do it before I believe it. Mm-hmm. And the other my biggest concern about Garbrandt is I'm worried about his chin. He's just – even if you want to get on Gaethje for being a stubborn brawler – you know for a fact how tough he is and his durability. He could take 100 billion punches before you get him out of there. I don't think that's the case with Cody. He's another guy with a background in wrestling, and we say this all the time, a guy with a background in wrestling who doesn't use the skills. It's guys all over the sport. I'll never understand it.
Yeah. I don't know if you want to intentionally be going to the mat with a Sun Tzu, though, so I think it'll probably be smarter for him to stay standing.
I just meant in general. He doesn't use it. And look, I'm not crazy on a Sun Tzu moving forward either. He's turns 38 years old next month, and you know, we just talked about earlier in the show about Tyron Woodley, who isn't 38 now and is clearly showing signs of decline, and obviously they're two different situations, but I just simply think when I looked at this, on top of the slight discount you're getting on a Sun Tzu, I just saw slightly more red flags with Garbrandt that had me worried. Mm-hmm. Would I be shocked if Cody won? Not at all. But I just think when you combine the value with the potential, and don't get me wrong, Garbrandt certainly has more theoretical long-term upside because he's younger, which always gives youth is the ultimate advantage in this sport. But if Cody's also been injury prone. You know, we didn't mention that. All the stuff after, you know, the T.J. Dillashaw fights and all the issues he had. So there are just too many red flags here for me to really get on Garbrandt. I'm not particularly, you know, optimistic about a Sun Tzu either, but when you combine the value, he just seems like a safer play.
Yeah, yeah. I did put in my notes something about the kind of injury history of Garbrandt. I mean, there's been back injuries, hand and wrist injuries. He was actually scheduled for the Sun Tzu fight in March 12th, but, kind of before the pandemic stuff. He ended up having to pull out. He went to the hospital for a weird shin infection and then had inflamed lymph nodes issue, flu-like symptoms, a lot of things that, you know, I didn't have any follow-up on that. You know, these guys definitely aren't required to submit to us a medical report, but there is some injury history there. But the biggest thing, like you touched on, is you have to, you know, when you're deciding how you want to handle this fight, you have to think, you have to pretty much make your opinion on Garbrandt's chin one way or another. And when I first saw this fight and I first saw the DraftKings salary, I immediately clicked a Sun Tzu into my lineup because of the value. And I'm thinking like, well, what does Garbrandt have here? You know, you have to decide. I kind of put it like this. In 2018, there are two fighters, James Vick and Beneil Dariush. James Vick had pretty much two straight knockouts, and he ended up getting knocked out two more times, and you know, people kind of think of him as toast now. And then on the other hand, you have Beneil Dariush in 2018, took two knockouts in three fights, but now he's back on a four-fight winning streak. He came back. So you have to decide which end of the spectrum here that you are on with Garbrandt. So I kind of look back at his other fights, and those three knockouts in a row, two of them were to TJ Dillashaw, who was pretty much juiced to the gills on EPO or whatever it was, you know, that self-admitted that. So how much did that play a role in the knockout? You know, you can't necessarily teach timing with those type of drugs, maybe not. And then the other one was Pedro Munhoz. And I watched the Munhoz fight against Aljamain Sterling before this, kind of in preparation to break down the next fight we're going to do. And Munhoz impresses the heck out of me. He's a beast. So if you're going to buy the chin narrative, you do have to take into context what some of those knockouts, you know, the context around some of those knockouts. So that started to kind of bring me more back in the direction of Garbrandt. And then the real big thing here is thinking about it from a DFS standpoint. I wouldn't be surprised if Asuncion's ownership is close to, if not greater, than that of Garbrandt. So, yeah, he'll be someone that will be low-owned by people trying to get 5 or 6 wins. But then you look, he hasn't scored 100 points in the history of DraftKings. The last time he did that was before DraftKings even existed here. So even if you are on Asuncion, I'm thinking pretty low exposure despite the low salary. I mean, you might have to because we'll see how many other viable underdog plays there are. But I mean, he's recorded 50 or more significant strikes just once in the last 5 years in a fight. He did have 4 takedowns in his last fight against Sandhagen, but remember that was in a loss. For me, he's more of a cash game underdog than a GPP player because his ceiling doesn't seem to be as high as that of Cody Garbrandt. You know, if Cody Garbrandt's chin holds up and he brings some of that knockout power that we've seen earlier, I mean, only 2 of Garbrandt's 9 UFC fights have went to decision. 3 of his first 4 fights in the UFC, Garbrandt finished. That's part of the reason he got to the title shot in the first place. And then I was so on the fence with this one, so going back and forth, and then I realized the smaller cage. And take a look at my Twitter. I tweeted out a graph that Richard Mann put together from a Fightnomics Read book. He illustrated it really well. Remember, the cage at the Apex Center is 5 feet shorter than the standard UFC cage. And if you look at like bantamweight through welterweight, there's a pretty big difference in stoppages. And I know we can't take the last card as the lone sample size. You know, we had a couple of submissions that kind of switched it. But the smaller cage plays a little bit of a role for me here, thinking someone like Asuncion, who I saw, you know, in the Sandhagen fight, that could just be a side effect of Sandhagen wanting to control the center of the octagon. But Asuncion kind of circling around the edge, there's less room to hide. If Garbrandt lands his one shot and then wants to follow up and find you, he might be able to find you. So I think when it's all said and done, I'm flipping my pick back to Cody Garbrandt. This is one I was very, very on the fence about, very hesitant about. But I think I'm going to go with Garbrandt because I think he can get the stoppage. I think the chin narrative might be a little bit overrated. And I think that the small cage goes into effect too much. But I want to hear from you, John. Am I overthinking this small cage thing, or is that a possible point here as we look at some of these bantamweight fights?
No, I think it's a decent point. I would think the small cage would favor a guy who's so aggressive like Garbrandt. Mm-hmm. Perhaps he can get Asuncion backed up against the cage. And, you know, we both certainly think he's the guy with more power. So I could certainly see how that would play to his advantage. I watching the small cage last week in the Woodley Burns card, I like it. I mm-hmm. wish they'd go with it all the time. Yeah, I think it makes the fights more entertaining.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it forces the action. There's more action. You know, I mean, there are definitely fighters out there that won't like it because of their style. But, man, I dig it. And it's awesome for DFS because these lighter weight fights suddenly become more in play than they might normally be. So, you know, that's great for me too.
Yeah, I think it's more entertaining. And I can understand why guys don't like it. It really limits your ability to kind of circle out if you're in trouble or whatever. You just don't have the lanes and the room to do so. But mm-hmm. I'd have no problem if they went to it full time. They won't, but it would mm-hmm. be cool if they did.
Yeah, on a standard card, you know, some of these bantamweight fights I don't think would be as appealing. But now this one, I think a lot of people are going to be on that same Asuncion narrative, the same reason I had him down originally, the same reason you've got him, which I don't take issue with. I think he could very well win this fight, but it might be a little bit low scoring. And I think that a lot of people are going to take that logic, use Asuncion as a lot of salary relief, and I think that's going to help drive Garbrandt's ownership percentage down as compared to most fighters in that tier. And I think that could actually be helpful. I would say that Garbrandt has a better chance to be in the millionaire winning lineup than Asuncion does. What do you think about that?
I think that's possible. I think if you're looking at people who are trying to get value, if they want to put Nunes in their lineup, I certainly think Asuncion, who's well known, is certainly an option given his cheap price. You might see a lot of people go with that duo.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, and that was my entire first instinct. I mean, that was the first 2 that I clicked. One, because, you know, if you're only doing one lineup, I like to backload them a little bit to kind of up the intensity at the end of the night. That, you know, not a strategy thing, just a fun thing. But those are the first 2 I clicked, and I can see a lot of people doing that. But let's move on to the next bantamweight fight, John. This one, like the past one, was one that I think I went back and forth on a couple times and finally settled here. We got Aljamain Sterling going up against Corey Sandhagen. This is pretty close to a pick 'em with the odds. Sterling minus 115, Sandhagen minus 105. I wouldn't be surprised if you saw them both at an even minus 110 towards the end of the week, in which case, you know, Sandhagen might have odds value in that case. But we've got Sterling at 8,200 on DraftKings, Sandhagen 8,000. Unlike the other bantamweight fight, the odds to finish on this one are plus 160. I watched, you know, some of these most recent fights, the Sandhagen Asuncial, the Sterling Munoz fight, among others, to try to get a better picture of this one. I had a really tough time with this one, but I want to let you go first and let us know how you see this fight, John.
I think this is by far the best fight on this card. I don't think it's particularly close. Mm-hmm. This is certainly the one I'm looking forward to the most, other than the main event, which has the title attached to it. I certainly think this is the fight. Well, I know this is the fight on this card with the highest stakes. There's no doubt about that. The winner here, I want to say Dana White has even come out and said the winner here is going to be next in line for the Jan Aldo winner of the vacant title. So this is major, this fight. And like you mentioned, this one's close. I had a really hard time picking this one.
I just want to interject. I honestly thought that they were going to slap a title on this after Cejudo and make this the co-main event, and that would allow them to build a card with two title fights on a card that isn't quite the same up and down as the last pay-per-view that was stacked. So I was actually surprised when they didn't make this fight for the title and are looking like they're going to do Jan Aldo instead. But just my two cents on that. It could be for a title.
Well, it definitely could. I think that's probably just more a case of the UFC trying to get two fights out of it instead of one. Mm-hmm. And my main argument with this was that I'm not crazy about the idea that one of these guys has to lose right now, but they're both young enough that they can rebuild their value even if they come up short. So looking at that a little deeper, I'm not too concerned. Look, it's close. Aljamain Sterling won four fights in a row. His last loss was against Moraes, a 67-second knockout, which maybe not the result, but I think how it happened was kind of fluky. Moraes just went Sterling just went and got clobbered and he was out. But this Sterling's good. He's tough. He's physical. He's an excellent wrestler, and he's always been a great wrestler. And unlike earlier, what we were talking, like Garbrandt, he knows he's a good wrestler and he uses his skills. But his striking's really improved. It's kind of what we said a little bit, what we used to always talk about Henry Cejudo, in the sense that, yes, we know your wrestling game is elite, but if you can just get your striking to just even average, the ceiling is so high. And Cejudo turned his striking into a strength. And, you know, I'd certainly argue that Sterling is on that, you know, on that path too. His stand up has really, really improved. He's always in good shape. The Moraes fight aside, he's durable. He's legit. If you watch his last couple fights, this four fight winning streak, if you watch each fight, he's legitimately improved every time out. You can be a casual fan and you can see the improvement just watching him. This is going to be tough. Sandhagen has really taken the division by storm, and his biggest asset is his size. It's really, really difficult to find a guy who makes 135 pounds with ease and stands 5'11". It's just hard to do. You can't find someone to spar with you who's who's your weight. And 5'11". And to Sandhagen's credit, he fights like a big guy in a division is supposed to. Well, the one example I always give when I talk about that is Stefan Struve, who is whatever he is, 7 feet tall or whatever, but still never truly realized how all he needs to do is just stand far away from guys so he can't get hit and just smash guys with kicks and long range strikes all day long. He just, he never figured that out. But Sandhagen is good at that. He lands 7.14 significant strikes a minute, which is ridiculous. And, in my article I wrote, that's unsustainable. But
The thing is, he just has 5 UFC fights, and that's where those things come from.
The sample size is small. I mean, by comparison, Sterling, the sample size is much larger, but Sterling lands less than 5 per minute. He's at 4.85.
Mm-hmm. Which is still top tier for the thing. So that's... That shows how crazy Sandhagen's number is.
Yeah, so even if Sandhagen drops from 7.14 to whatever, I don't know, say 5.5 or something like that, that just gives you an idea that it's still a massive number. I went back and forth here, just like I did on the last one. I ended up settling on Sterling, and the main reason was that I trust Ray Longo and Matt Serra, Sterling's coaches, to realize how much of an advantage he should have on the mat. I think Aljamain is going to make a concerted effort to not get an extended kickboxing match with Sanhagen. He's certainly the better wrestler. And we go back to that small sample size you mentioned. Sanhagen has only had a handful of fights in the UFC, but his takedown defense is 27%, which is abysmal. You know, we always say, you know, average, I would say, what would you say average is? Somewhere around 70, something like, you know.
70
somewhere.
Would be pretty good. Yeah, 80 70, would be elite, you know.
90, like, to give you an example, Tyron Woodley takedown defense when he came, he had the highest in welterweight history when he entered the octagon last weekend, and I want to say he was at like 93 or 94% or something, you know, some crazy number. But 27% is not good. And you mentioned the Sun Tzu took him down on multiple occasions. Yes, Sanhagen won the fight, but Sun Tzu took him down on multiple occasions, and you know, I certainly think at this point in Sun Tzu's career that Sterling is a bigger threat. So, look, this is close. If Sanhagen can somehow stay on his feet, he's definitely the better striker. He's bigger. He's longer. He probably has more one-punch knockout power. But I ended up going with Sterling. Look, the salaries and the odds are, you know, it's essentially a pick'em. So I imagine the ownership of both guys is going to be about even. Maybe you'll get a slight edge towards Sanhagen because she'll save a couple hundred bucks or whatever it is. But I think this is going to be close, and everything reflects that.
Yeah. So going into this, I always kind of thought of Sterling as maybe a middle of the road contender, and I think I was blinded a little bit by some of the performances from earlier in his career. You know, when he took back to back decision losses, the Brian Caraway and Rafael Asunciao, you know, both split decisions, so could have been there. And then of course he got stopped by Marlon Moraes, you know, pretty instantly in December of 2017. You know, I had those images in my head. But it really took the recent film session for me to come around, because Pedro Munhoz, Jimmy Rivera, he put on just incredible striking performances in those things. And I think that's like we saw, you know, guys with Cejudo that were like Cejudo that were wrestling based, that start to see their striking really develop. I mean, Sterling, he has that excellent camp. You mentioned the Longo Serra fight team combo. 101 significant strikes against Rivera, 174 significant strikes against Pedro Munhoz. And I was watching him, and I think he is just, he's in such phenomenal physical shape. He's an explosive athlete that he's perfect for a three-round fight, because those explosive moves that he likes to try isn't going to necessarily cost him or drain the gas tank over the course of a five-round fight. So I've been very impressed with what I've seen of Sterling of late. And not that I haven't been impressed with what I've seen of Sanhagen, but I just haven't seen as much. And I really, you know, the last couple fights, even the Munhoz fight, really sold me on Sterling. So I think my pick here is going to be Sterling. I think he's a good DraftKings play, because even though the odds to finish are plus 160, he's 8,200. I mean, your average per fighter is 8,333. So you technically get a little bit of salary relief using him. And he does have a chance to hit that 10X, because look at in his last fight. I mean, granted, Pedro Munhoz is a guy that's going to bring the fight to you and is willing to get hit. But 174 significant strikes he was credited with. So that leaves the door open to get 10X even in a decision. So I like that. I did want to make a case for Sanhagen, though, just because, you know, to try to see the other side of the coin, because we both kind of have the Sterling picks. Sterling did look good in that last fight against Munhoz, but he faded a little bit towards the end, and he took a lot of shots. I mean, he did absorb 105 significant strikes, and his left leg was starting to be almost to the point where it was toast in round three. He hit it really well, but, you know, his left leg definitely took a beating, and, you know, he's had over a year to recover from that, so I'm not worried about anything like that. But in Sandhagen's fight against Asunciao, 23 of his 62 significant strikes were to the leg. Sanhagen has very impressive leg kicks. He utilizes that low calf kick that's become so popular in MMA, and I think that Sanhagen could give him trouble with the leg kicks, but I have enough faith in Sterling to kind of lean on that wrestling background to take the fight to the mat should that become an issue at any point. And then Sterling, of course, has shown the strides in his striking game. So I think in all the aspects of MMA, the big ones here, I'm going to give Sterling the edge, and I think it'll be Sterling that will be fighting Piotr Jan for the Bantamweight Championship at some point in late 2020 or early 2021. This one goes to Sterling for me. I might have a little Sandhagen exposure too. I mean, the price is so low for a fighter of his caliber. I'm going to get both sides of this across the lineup construction here, but the edge in exposure is going to go to Sterling, and the straight up pick is Sterling to win the fight. So that's how I see that one.
Yeah, you make some good points about Sterling the early portion of his career, but you can watch his last few fights and be a casual fan and legitimately see the guy keeps getting better and better. It's no secret.
Yeah, the improvement, the path, the trajectory. I just like where he's going, and I mean, Sandhagen's super young, and he could very well be a future champion too. I have him ranked pretty high on some dynasty rankings I put out, I don't know, maybe a month ago when we were in a big hiatus that I needed some content to throw out there. But Sandhagen's definitely high in that sense, but I don't think he's quite there just yet. I think he drops this one to Sterling. So it was one of the toughest ones I've had to make. This, again, I went back and forth with, but I'm sticking to my original one and going Sterling in this one. And I feel pretty confident in that one now. So I'm going to move on here. We got a welterweight bout. You know, we're going to take a break from the bantamweights for just a second. Neil Magny, Anthony Rocco Martin. Magny 8,700. Martin 7,500. Magny a minus 145 betting favorite. Come back on Martin plus 125. I know you've had mixed feelings about Magny over the years, John, but what do you think his chances are of pulling this one out?
Well, I'm going to pick him, which means he's certainly going to lose because Magny fights a lot. Magny's like the most active fighter on the roster, and I think I've literally picked against him like a dozen times in a row, and he almost always wins. So I'm probably wrong here, but I'm going to go with him. The story on Magny hasn't changed. It's always been the same. Nothing he does inside the octagon is pretty. He doesn't have a ton of power. He's not particularly athletic. It's not a sexy profile, if you want to say. But the guy wins more than he loses. Yeah. And the track record
shows it.
It does. And he wins more than he loses. And you know, I think Magny could retire tomorrow, and you would have to term his career a gigantic success. I'll never forget back early in his UFC career. He fought Gasan Umalatov February 2014, UFC 169 in New Jersey. And I was there's the first fight on the card. And he was a nobody. And he's probably had a good, 15, 20 UFC fights since then. What Magny is really good at, one, he has good size to the division, 6'3". So that certainly helps him. But he's just really good and making fight-by-fight adjustments. We were talking earlier about Cody Garbrandt, about how he doesn't do that, how he's the same guy no matter who he's facing. Magny is willing to change up his game plan in order to win a fight, which is what you're supposed to do. He got destroyed by Santiago Ponzinibbio back in November 2018, which wasn't shocking. Ponzinibbio's, an excellent fighter. Mm-hmm. But Magny returned this past March against Li Jingliang in a fight. I believe Li was favored, and Magny.
Oh yeah, Li was a big favorite.
Yeah, Magny took a pretty healthy unanimous decision there. That wasn't close. He won that one going away.
It was dominant. 74-16 in significant strikes, 4-2 in takedowns. He passed guard twice. Showed him a complete all around, just excellent performance in that one against someone that was overmatched.
Yeah, as I said, Magny fights a lot. And he's lost twice since August 2016. So, we're going on 4 years now. And those setbacks came against Ponzinibbio and Rafael dos Anjos. So, you're looking at two of the best fighters in the sport. No shame in losing to either of those guys. Now, Tony Martin, Anthony Rocco Martin, it's a little bit of a different situation. The record's positive. He's 5-1 in his last six fights. The lone loss was a lopsided fight against Damian Maia where he was just smothered and run out of the building. I'm kind of split here because Martin is, if you watch Martin fight, he's definitely better than he was early in his UFC career. The improvements are noticeable. He does a lot of things well. I wouldn't say he does anything great. But there are red flags that as you dig, you pick up some red flags. He has one knockout in his entire career, and he's a submission specialist, which is fine. But if you're a submission specialist, you have to generally be able to get the fight to the ground. And Martin averages under one takedown, well under one takedown, 0.68 per 15 minutes. So he has problems getting his opposition to the mat, where he can implement what is his biggest strength. So he relies on his opposition to make mistakes, and that's one of the reasons I'm going to take Magny here. Say what you want about Magny. You know, he doesn't have a ton of power. He's not a great athlete. Magny is never overwhelmed inside the octagon. He fights at his pace. He sticks with his game plan, and he just goes about his business. And I think for Martin to win this fight, I think Magny is going to have to do something stupid, and that's not how he fights. So I'm going to go with Magny. As I said earlier, I'm probably wrong, but I think this is the pick here. I do think he's a little overpriced. I'm not crazy about his salary. $8,700 seems like too much for me. I'd feel a lot better if he was more like $8,300, $8,400, somewhere in there. $8,700 is a little high, but I do think he's going to win.
You're not getting great odds value on that with him being around minus 145, but way up there at $8,700. You know, it's not super great, but... Yeah, this is another fight I had a really hard time with. You know, we're back and forth here. Magny is very capable of putting up big scoring on DraftKings. I mean, he put up 102 against Kelvin Gastelum in a loss. You know, he's had some massive nights. He had 139 against Hector Lombard once. This is a little bit of a different story here. For me, though, I'll start by saying I was crazy impressed with his impressive performance against Leech in March of 2020, so pretty recently. I was impressed by that, and at first I thought that I was going to for sure pick him away, just pick him going away. You know, I bought the improvement. He looked like he used his long time off to really get better as a fighter. But I'm not crazy about him in DFS, one, because of the price tag, two, because this will be a generally tough opponent to land on. I mean, Rocco Martin absorbs 2.45 significant strikes per minute, which, you know, not that great. You know, at least he has a positive striking differential. But, man, I've been back and forth on this one. I was originally going to pick Magny squaring away, but what I do think is that Rocco Martin has a better chance of being in the millionaire lineup, because Magny's path to victory here is pretty much most likely a decision, which he can be productive in a decision, but Martin's path to victory, on the other hand, is I think it's a submission, and I think Magny can be submitted because in his seven losses, he's been submitted four times, and it's usually been to crazy leak grapplers, and like you said, there are questions about Rocco Martin's, you know, his ability to get takedowns, but we just had that takedown defense discussion. Magny has only been taken down twice in like his last five fights or something like that, but his takedown defense is still only 59%, which isn't, it's not horrific, but it's not necessarily what I'd call elite by any means. So, man, you know, I've been back and forth even right up until this very moment, but I think I'm going to go with Rocco Martin here. I'm going to make that pick. I'm going to say by submission, because he's someone that you might need to get a little crafty with in DFS. I don't think I'm going to have a lot of Magny in DFS, maybe like 20% tops because of that price tag, and I have doubts about his ability to hit value there. You know, I could very well wake up tomorrow morning, post that fix, and feel differently about this, but I think I'm going to go Rocco Martin now, but this one's very, very tight.
Yeah, this is another close one. The last three fights you spoke about are all close. I don't feel particularly comfortable about either guy from a DraftKings setting. Mm-hmm. So if you have other people, other fighters you think might pay off better, or you feel more comfortable about, you know, this might be one you want to look at skipping and, you know, mixing and playing around with things.
Yeah, exactly. There's some interesting ones on the underdog, or on the undercard, I should say, to, you know, possibly mix in as well. Guys in that 8,700 tier that I like a little bit better to get a stoppage here, but we'll talk about that a little bit more at the end here. I want to talk about a bantamweight matchup between Eddie Wineland and Sean O'Malley. Back to the bantamweights here. This one, though, in terms of the analysis, leans a little bit closer to that first fight of the card than the last three we talked about. You know, this is O'Malley's a big favorite running away. He's a minus 475 betting favorite. The comeback on Wineland is plus 380. O'Malley on DraftKings here is 9,300, and Wineland is 6,900. I think you've got what I see here is a young prospect that Dana White, Sean Shelby, and company would not put him in a spot they think he could lose to open up a pay-per-view, because I think they want to see him as marketable. He's an asset. They want to get him fans. They want to get him a stoppage. The odds to finish on this are minus 285. So welcome to the Sugar Show. This is a pretty easy fight for me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, nothing fancy here. I think they're pretty much, like you mentioned, I think the UFC is openly essentially sacrificing Eddie Wineland for this fight. Wineland was a really good fighter at one point, former WEC bantamweight champion. But he's turned 36 years old later this month. He's 4-5 dating back to September 2013, and stylistically, this is a horrible matchup for him. Wineland is just a straightforward bite down on the mouthpiece, come after you brawler, and that's the last type of opponent he should be facing at this stage of his career is a young 5'11" creative striker like O'Malley. Mm-hmm. I agree with you in the sense I don't think the UFC would put O'Malley in a spot where they thought they could fail. They thought he could fail, and anything can happen in this sport. That's why they have the fights. But this one's really easy. I think O'Malley really has. You know, we're going to need to see him fight against higher level competition, and this isn't that. You know, I don't think even if O'Malley wins this one in 10 seconds, you know, it's not going to do a ton for him in the sense that this is a fight he was supposed to win. Mm-hmm. But I do think I think the ceiling here is really, really high, and I have zero interest in Wineland despite the dirt cheap salary.
Yeah, I mean, if O'Malley wins in dominant fashion, that'll be two early stoppages in a row for him. What's next? It will be tough. He might take the loser of one of the earlier bantamweight fights, but even that might be too much of a step up for him. I don't know. That's going to be tight. But the big question I have here is, since they're about the same price, who scores more, Nunes or Sugar Show?
Oh, Jesus. I believe it or not, it's hard.
If you had to put a money line on it, I think the edge would go to Nunes because there's two extra rounds.
That was exactly what I was going to say. I want it straight up. I kind of want to say O'Malley, but Nunes has the two extra rounds. Now, it's anybody's guess if the fight doesn't end before then and she doesn't get to use those two extra rounds, but that's certainly an advantage.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, Spencer was pretty tough out there against Cyborg, so I think O'Malley might have a better shot of putting Wineland away in the very first round or early than Nunes does Spencer, but I'm not saying that can't happen either. I mean, Nunes, she's the GOAT for a reason. Her strikes are just tremendously well-timed. She's very well-coached. It's going to be tough, man. This is the first DraftKings lineup. If you're using, say a couple of those underdogs, say you use some of the guys, Asuncio and Rocco Martin, it's not completely out of the question to put both Nunes and O'Malley in a lineup. And I think that's going to be a winning combination. I just joined a pool last week with a Twitter friend that you have to pick three fighters on every single card. And basically three fighters to win. Doesn't matter the odds, doesn't matter how many times you use someone, but then when one fighter loses, you only get two picks for the next card, and it's like Survivor. It keeps going. And I know for a fact I'm picking Nunes and O'Malley. The third one is what I'm struggling on a little bit, and we'll have to get to that towards the end of the week. I'm starting to lean Menefield, but I'm getting to that. But before we get too far on the undercard, let's talk about some upsets, John. Anything else, any notes on the card, any fights that you're particularly excited for, or guys that you think have a real shot at an upset?
Well, I mean, the fight I'm looking forward to most is easy. That's Sandhagen and Sterling. Mm-hmm. The one guy I thought, when I looked at the salaries and all that stuff, the one guy I thought on the undercard who I thought had a decent chance of paying off was Jussie Formiga at 7,900. Fighting Alex Perez, who's 8,300. Formiga's plus 120, Perez minus 140. And, for a long time, Formiga was one of the most underrated fighters in the flyweight division. He never got any press, but just went about his business. Had a bit of a rough run recently, back-to-back losses, knockout against Joseph Benavidez, unanimous decision against Brandon Moreno. But, this is a guy who's been, who has big wins in his career. He beat Devastin Figueiredo last March, so only about a year ago, via unanimous decision. So this is a guy with big wins under his belt. You know, he's hoping Figueiredo wins the title eventually, and he can run out his spiel. Hey, I beat that guy about a year ago. I'm next in line. So I looked at that, and I thought he was definitely a potential value play.
Yeah, I like him. I believe we own him in our Dynasty League that we do together.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so we'll have a chance. I felt pretty good. Someone was trying to trade for him before the Moreno fight, and I was like, we need to get a certain amount of fights in. A lot of that league is about volume, having guys that fight a lot, and I was like, I don't think I can give up a fight plus one that I think he's going to win. And then, of course, he goes out and loses to Moreno, and he's there. But I think, the activity is absolutely – it's very helpful. So, I agree with that too. Alex Perez has looked pretty good, won four of his first five fights. But, I don't know about the finishing rate on this one. And Formiga doesn't do a whole lot of striking, so he's not a great DraftKings scorer. But I think he's a good cash game play because he has a pretty good chance to win for someone that is an underdog and, of course, helps – lead you to getting Nunes and O'Malley in this one. Here's one that I'm interested in a little bit. He's kind of a big dog, but he paid off for me the last time I used him on DraftKings. So there's a little bit of a soft spot there. I am talking about Brian Kelleher, who enters as a +225 underdog against Cody Stammen. He continues to be an underdog, and he continues to come through here. I think that even with the move up in weight to featherweight, he's got some power in his hands. Now, Cody Stammen, arguably a step up from Ode Osborne and Hunter Azure. But, back-to-back post-fight bonuses for Boom Keller. He's got four bonuses in his career. I know he's up a weight class, but he's pretty cheap. And I don't know. He's got enough power in his hands to maybe sneak into that Millie lineup. You with me there, or are you on Stammen?
I like Stammen to win. I just – my problem with Kelleher is every time he's fought somebody who you would consider better competition, he's lost. And that worries me a little. And I actually think Stammen's pretty good. I'd have no problem getting a piece of Kelleher somewhere. I think he's a decent play, but I like Stammen to win that fight.
Yeah, maybe that's – partially when you draft a guy in a fantasy league one year, he has an awesome year, you want to draft him again next year because you feel good about him, or a guy sours you, vice versa. I think I might have a little bit of that coming in, but I don't know. Boom Kelleher maybe has a shot here with me. I want to see what the I haven't really referred to the ELO much on that Fight Matrix site here. It's still pretty heavy on Stammen. I see that. Anybody else you're looking at? Like for that pool I'm looking at, I'm looking for another favorite that is likely to get a stoppage, and I'm kind of down between a Charles Byrd and an Alonzo Menifield. He's going up against pretty much a pure wrestler in Devin Clark. Any value in any of those guys at all?
It's hard. The one guy I thought really was a decent value was I liked Herbert Burns against Evan Dunham. At the time I wrote my preview article, this fight was made recently, within the last handful of days. By the time I wrote the article, they didn't have DraftKings salaries up for this fight.
I got to go put them in there.
Yeah, we were able to get Vegas odds. Dunham is +200. Burns is -240. But we weren't able to get the salaries at the time. But hey, Burns is the brother of Gilbert Burns, who we saw what he did to Tyron Woodley last week. So something good going on in that family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's interesting. I'm glad that they have 12 fights too, because the last couple have kind of been at 11, and that makes things pretty difficult from a DFS standpoint, especially when you get the situations like the Rodriguez-Holland last week, where Rodriguez stays at 7,300, which is very cheap, and then suddenly becomes a -370, 380 favorite, So that what happens then is you get a ton of duplicate lineups, and even if you win the million, you're splitting it 20, 30, 40 ways, so it's not as cool of a payday here. This, at least with 12 fights, hopefully, knock on wood, they all stay intact. There's some tough weight cuts ahead, but hopefully they all stay intact, and we have a full 12-fight card, and maybe someone out there can go ahead and bank that $1 million for themselves. That'd be pretty cool. Of course, to do that, you got to leave salary on the table, and you definitely have to be confident in some of those dogs. So it's going to be tough, man, but it's exciting times for us and our sport and for the content we produce, and we really appreciate everyone checking in and listening. So I think we'll wrap it up with that. Thanks again for listening to the podcast, of course, brought to you by ESPN+, the only place that you can watch UFC 250. John, any closing thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I just, you know, if, you know, you're going after that million, just remember your lineup's going to look weird. You know, you're going to look at your lineup, mm-hmm. you submit, and you're going to say, oh, wow, you know, this isn't going to win me anything. Mm-hmm. That's the lineup that's going to win it. So just remember that when you're making your changes and, you think your lineup isn't a winning lineup because you have underdogs and all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're one, if your lone entry in the Millionaire Maker uses all of your salary or only leaves $1,200 on the table, like maybe you want to rethink that because GPP, and maybe you want to take that lineup, go put it in a cash game and then try a new one for this GPP, because I'm with you. Definitely got to be a little bit unique here in this situation. I mean, obviously, neither of us think Wineland or Spencer has a chance, but if one of them comes out and gets the most shocking first-round upset since Holm-Rousey, then all of a sudden, you've got a fast track to the Millionaire Maker. So that would be something, man. But I'm warming up to this card. I wasn't too excited about it eventually, but these bantamweight fights are outstanding, and it's going to be a fun time here. But again, that's going to do it. Once again, I'm Jake Litarski. Follow me at Roto Jake. He's John Littering. You can follow him at JonLitterine. We're going to be back with you guys prior to UFC 251, whenever and wherever that might be. Maybe Fight Island might see the debut of Fight Island if that's in July, but definitely stay tuned to rotowire.com/MMA. Follow at RotoWire MMA for all the latest fight updates. We'll keep you posted, and best of luck to you guys with all your lineups.